Tonight at 6 on Hometown Heroes,
a decorated pilot who flew just about every fighter plane America had during World War II with more close calls than he can count.
A 20-millimeter shell hit me right in the wing. It put a hole in there I could put my head through.
But he made it, an incredible 180 missions. Hear it as this 95-year-old remembers it on Hometown Heroes. Tonight, 6 p.m. on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. When I say that, I mean men and sometimes women who were willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of us and our country's future. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired from these stories and by these men like Duke Ellington. I bet you never thought you were going to hear Duke Ellington on Hometown Heroes. Strike up the band. Where's the jazz? I don't hear it. Oh, it's not that Duke Ellington. It's a World War II decorated fighter pilot with over 180 missions. But that's what they called you in World War II, right? Duke Ellington?
You always get a nickname.
Yeah, and I guess if you grow up with the last name Ellington, at that time in our history, it was just natural, huh?
It was natural. That's right.
But your parents called you Ed.
Ed, absolutely.
Or did they call you Eddie?
Well, unfortunately, I grew up with Eddie, and it took a long time for me to get Ellington to shorten it to Ed.
Some people still call you Eddie, don't they?
Yeah, my sisters do.
Your sisters out here in Reedley, California, where we're talking today, and your niece, Patty Hickson, who's the general manager of the radio station that this program started on many years ago. So we thank Patty for letting me know about Uncle Eddie. She's been telling me about you for a long time.
I'll be darned.
And everything that she said was true, because I've read some of your memoirs, but I want to share your story with our audience today. And let's start at the beginning. You grew up, you were born on a ranch in South Dakota.
Exactly.
Is that your secret? Is that why you're still in such good shape and so tough all these years later? It's just the South Dakota thing?
Well, I don't know, but I was always active. I've been always active physically. So it's enjoyment for me. There were seven of us. I was the oldest of seven. I had two brothers, and Brother John was in the Navy. He was the most prominent one. He was very active in the Navy. He was a little short guy, but he was very outgoing and became the favorite of everybody. Mm-hmm. Brother John did. Dar was more inclined to be quiet, opposite of John.
Well, let's talk about you. So growing up out there in South Dakota.
Yeah.
What were your big dreams? What were your ideas about what you were going to do with yourself?
Of course, you know, as my age, I grew up in the very, very heart of the Depression. And so I was going to a teacher's college. That was a way of making a living. So I went to the teacher's college. I would have gotten the degree there, but the war came along, and I quickly went to war. After the war, I went back to Iowa State and got a bachelor's degree.
But before the war, this was Black Hill, what is now known as Black Hill State University in Spearfish, South Dakota, where you played football.
Yeah.
We just had another Black Hill State athlete on this show here recently.
Really?
From the reservation in Pine Ridge, Seth Irving. But you were maybe a year or two older than he was. But before you got to Black Hill State, your love for flying, or at least your ambition for aviation,
yeah,
was already there?
I didn't really get started till I got to Black Hill State, where they offered the training.
What made you want to fly? What was it about that?
Well, golly, you know, I think any young boy would like to fly. That was just a natural thing. And we had a nice little airport close to the college, 3 miles or so. And gosh, you get to fly, you know, and it wasn't going to cost me anything. And it's made my life.
I guess so. I wonder what would have been different had you not started flying when you were there.
I'd have probably became a country school teacher.
You think so?
Yeah.
I've got to ask you this just because I've never lived there, but I've heard a lot of stories from folks who did. How bad were the winters in South Dakota when you were growing up?
Oh, they were bad. I mean, 40 below was common.
Common.
We even experienced 50 below, 50, 55. All that in South Dakota, but you grow up with it. And you got to have the clothes to go with it. And, of course, in the Depression, that was hard to do.
Sure.
But I can't say that I became immune to cold weather. I didn't. But you know, you always found some way to dress for it.
Yeah. And there are so many military things I want to talk to you about with 180 missions. I'm sure we could take days to go over this. But this is kind of fascinating to me also, because one of the reasons I do this show is to give young people, younger than I am, a chance to get a little perspective about what life was like back then and how well we have it now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just thinking, if you're one of seven kids during the Depression in South Dakota, there are probably a lot of things you have now that you didn't have back then.
We were actually, the word destitute was what it amounts to, because the income became so slight. For example, when I was 14 years old, I told them I was 18 and went to the CCC's. Not 25 bucks went home and five to me. That's how stringent things were then.
Mm-hmm.
Just terrible.
And so folks who don't know, that's the Civilian Conservation Corps. So basically you were going to work. This is some pretty intense labor that you're carrying out as a 14-year-old just to try to help your family survive.
Absolutely. I was born to a pick and shovel when I went to the CCC's. That's what we were doing. We were building a dam, and the first thing we had to build was a keyhole for the concrete key. We dug a keyhole down well over 100 feet.
With picks and shovels?
With pick and shovel.
Wow. That's not easy.
No.
At 14?
At 14.
Everybody who hears this program is going to be sure not to mess with you, because they can tell already how tough you are. And I don't want to belabor the point. What about food? Did you guys have a cow? I mean, did you get milk on the farm? How did you
Well,
eat?
I tell you, we had my Uncle Darwin passed away, left us some money, and we had this nice little house in Spearfish, and there was a place there we could keep a cow. But it was a nice little house, and there's an irrigation ran through there. I don't remember how the hell we kept the cow, but we had a little outdoor building. That was, I would call that the later part. There was the earlier part, which was more difficult.
Yeah, so when you had a cow, that was probably a luxury to have fresh milk and be able to make butter and everything.
Oh, yeah, it was, yes.
As far as aviation, you remember the first time you got to fly solo and what that felt like?
Oh, the first solo was out of Spearfish Airport in a Luscombe airplane.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I had a very competent, attractive woman instructor.
Ah, little incentive.
What was her name?
Evelyn Sharp, right? I was reading your memoirs. I think it was Evelyn Sharp.
Golly, she was great.
Had you always wanted to be a fighter pilot? Because a lot of the guys, they tell me they went into the Air Corps, and maybe they end up a navigator, a bombardier. They're on a bomber crew, but the reason they got into the Air Corps to begin with was they wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Yeah, that's me. I wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Why? What was so exciting about that?
There was a chance that you could shoot down a German airplane, that you could become an ace. Of course, I never even came close. It was the excitement was of you in your own airplane doing the war instead of being the crew.
You had a little more control, in theory.
Yep.
I'm sure there are a lot of missions where you didn't feel like you were in control.
No. No.
And you got to fly just about every plane the Army Air Corps had at that time, huh? At least test out in them?
The fighter stuff, old P-36s were still flying.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to be competent in the P-36. Then we had the P-38s came in, the twin engine, we got that. Then we went to the P-40s again. Finally, I got the P-51s. I had been through them all.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a favorite of all those?
Oh, the 51 by far. It had performance and acrobatic ability. I mean, it was versatile and a lot of armament, 650 caliber. So the 51 was my favorite, although most of my missions were at P-40s.
Right, yeah, you had to stay in for a while to even get a chance to fly the P-51.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you were flying missions pretty early.
Yeah.
June of 42, you get assigned to the 57th Fighter Group.
Uh-huh.
That group's got quite a history, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you're a big part of that history.
Yeah.
Were you eager to get overseas and do something?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. That was a part of the game.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize when they think of World War II fighter pilots, they think, okay, well, if you were in the Army Air Corps, you were flying from an airfield in England or maybe in Italy. They don't realize that the early missions in North Africa, that you had Army Air Corps planes and squadrons taking off from Navy aircraft carriers. You went over on an aircraft carrier, didn't you?
Went over on an aircraft carrier, yeah.
The Ranger?
Went over on the Ranger and flew off in East Africa, about at the equator. Flew across basically the equator, the north up the Nile River. And then we were based there for 2-3 weeks. And then we joined the British and went from there, from East Africa to West Africa, across the top of Africa.
But going over there, you don't know what to expect. You've never been through any of this before.
No.
And you're crossing the Atlantic on this aircraft carrier, the Ranger. And this is early in the war. There's still U-boats everywhere sinking American ships. Were you guys a little nervous that was going to happen to you?
Oh, we were constantly alert for the subs. That was happening all the time. The subs were a constant threat.
I know there have been a lot of people over the years that wanted to talk to you about what you did, because what you did was so trailblazing at the time. And I have some of the things you've written over the years, and it says on your journey over there, July of 42, as you put it, on July 4th, we had our fireworks, and I don't think they were celebrating our revolution. You said a German wolf pack was most aggressive, but so were our destroyers. So you guys had those escorts that took care of
them. Oh, they saved our fanny, no question about it.
But it also says here that you heard Axis Sally on the radio saying that the Ranger had been sunk.
Yeah, she determined us to be a goner.
Did you get a chuckle out of that?
Oh, of course. You know, here we are, safe and sound, and she's reporting that we're down.
And 70 years later, you still can't believe everything you hear on the radio, I guess. So, had you ever taken off of an aircraft carrier before?
No, no.
So here you are. This is 1942, so you're 22 years old. You're flying a P-40 off the deck of an aircraft carrier. Again, I'm reading some of your memoirs here, and you didn't have a whole lot of room there. And here goes the ship trying to keep it steady for you guys to take off. And it's going about 30 knots into the wind so you guys can try to take off. And you guys weren't sure you were going to make it off of that ship.
No, in fact, it was difficult with those conditions because you couldn't avoid going off the end of the carrier and going down until you got more speed. So you went off and went down till you were pretty close to the water, and then up made it.
So the slightest miscalculation or unfortunate blip in the wind or the weather, and you're swimming.
Wouldn't have been healthy.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had 180 missions. But you got off, as nervous as that was, and then you went and landed in Africa.
Yeah.
How different a world was that from what you grew up with in South Dakota?
You can only imagine a countryside boy getting into all this. You acclimatized. That's all there was to it. You became part of this thing, and it was okay.
Another thing I saw was that you, early on in these missions in Africa, you dealt with some serious vertigo.
Yeah, that's true.
That's got to be absolutely frightening.
Well, it is for a while. No question about it. You don't know whether you're up or down, for one thing. I mean, you don't know your position in the sky. That's what it amounts to for a short time. You're just lost in the sky.
What snaps you out of something like that?
You maneuver the airplane in various conditions so that you come back to life again.
Those early missions, these are all in P-40s. You mentioned you're flying in conjunction with British planes. What were your targets? What kind of missions were these? What was the objective?
Oh, these were always against the ground targets. And then quite often, then we'd get into air battles.
So the ground war in North Africa is going on, and you guys would fly in these P-40s, dive bomb and strafe German forces. They're shooting at you too, though, right?
Oh, you betcha. Oh, yeah. You get hit too.
I've seen some pictures and read some of your stories, like about a wing you could stand up and stick your head through.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that one. What happened there? How did that big of a hole develop in your wing?
Well, this was well into mid-North Africa when I was down low on the deck strafing. We were running against German 20-millimeter stuff. A 20-millimeter shell hit me right in the wing, and it put a hole in there I could put my head through. And it didn't fly so good after that, but I could keep on flying and land it. After I got out of the German area, I put it down.
How frequent was that, that you would bring a plane back from a mission and it was shot
at? Holes in it. I experienced at least a half a dozen of those kinds of missions where you got shot by 20 millimeter or 30 caliber or something, you know.
Well, we need to take a break, but we'll hear more of those stories when we come back. If you want to see what this Silver Star and Distinguished Flying Cross recipient looked like then and what he looks like now, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a decorated World War II fighter pilot who logged an incredible 180 missions during the war in two separate tours. Originally from South Dakota, Ed Ellington lives in Seattle, Washington now. During World War II, his fellow pilots in the 57th Fighter Group knew him as Duke Ellington. His instrument was not the piano, but the P-40 Warhawk. And speaking of those fellow pilots, I know you had a lot of respect for him. What can you tell us about the kind of men that you were serving with?
Well, I think all of us just kind of did what we thought we were expected to do. I don't know that we had to go through any special mental adjustment. I suppose we did. I don't know. We were expected to do this work and you'd fly mission after mission and not get any damage. So it wasn't always extremely dangerous.
And how often would you guys be flying? Almost every day?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was almost every day. Yeah.
Did that wear you out?
No, I don't think so. You know, we're 20-plus years old and pretty solid youth. I can't say it wore us out.
Did you think you were invincible?
Oh, yeah. They had entertained some of the thoughts that you weren't going to get hit. Yeah. Yeah.
This is a question I ask a lot of people, and maybe it seems cliche, but I've heard every end of the spectrum on it. Were you ever scared over there? Did you ever think, you know, I might not make it back home?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sometimes they're scared as hell. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What other answers do you get?
Oh, some people say, no, they never really were. They honestly never were. And then I have some guys that say, if anyone tells you he wasn't scared, he's a liar. So it runs the spectrum. So a lot of your missions also were escorting American and British bombers. Mm-hmm. And in that role of fighter escort, you guys dealt quite a bit with German fighter planes.
Yeah.
The ME-109s?
Yeah. The sadness of my whole story is that I didn't get one.
You didn't get to shoot one down.
Yeah. And I had some opportunities, but, you know, I have one leg that's longer than the other.
From birth?
Yeah. And I didn't know that until I got in the Army Air Corps, and they sort of mentioned it. But I found in my flying years that I unconsciously was pushing the right rudder more than the left rudder. I shouldn't have been pushing the left rudder at all. I was pushing the right rudder, which skewed the bullets. And I missed opportunities because I was missing the target.
How about that?
Yeah, well, and it's because, you know, now you're in an intense situation, and the right foot's going up there first, and you're shooting, and the bullets are screwing all over the place. And so I didn't get as many as I should have, or I didn't get any, but I should have got more than one.
And there's one particular, well, I know there's a lot of them that I want to hear about, but tell me about this one. I'm just, again, reading from some of the things you've written over the years. And this is when Major Art Salisbury led an attack mission designed to hit a German airstrip on the coast at El Daba just before daylight. So there's all this, you said there was anticipation and tension at extreme levels because you guys are taking off at night. And it was going to be a high adrenaline situation. You came in right on target. You surprised the Germans with their 109 still on the ground. But then those 109s got scrambled, got up in the air, and you're trying to fly away from there flat on the desert deck. And all of a sudden, you start hearing something in your headset.
Someone was saying, you've got a 109 on your tail or something to that effect. Turn left or break left or whatever it was.
But you look back, and there's nothing back there. So you look behind you, it wasn't there. And then they tell you again, ship flying straight ahead, turn, turn, turn. And then you looked up, and it was diving on you?
Yeah.
So what did you see when you looked up?
It just had to be the nose of a 109 coming in, coming down from the top.
Mm-hmm.
And a 109 is an unfriendly bird.
And he's got the angle on you. He's got speed coming straight down with you in his sights. If you don't do something, you're a goner.
I'm a goner.
So what'd you do?
Turn hard, hard left. I mean, that was our typical defense against German attack, was to pull as strong of a turn as you could because they couldn't follow us. Once we got away from them on a turn, they were done.
And you don't have much margin for error because you're already on the deck. I mean, you're barely above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So you turn and you see his 20-millimeter shells hitting the ground right next to you. But then once you made that turn, you got away, thankfully.
Yeah.
And another note that you had about that incident was that you lost two pilots that day. And that makes me wonder, what was that like when you would have a mission and you come back and you realize, hey, those guys took off with us, but they didn't make it back?
Well, you know, of course, they're friends of yours, and you have to hurt, but you can't live with it. I mean, you have to get it out of your system, even though maybe one of them or both of them are a classmate of yours. You're that close to the other people with you. You're very close. And when you lose one or two or whatever, it hurts. But you got to get it out of your system.
That's understandable. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to function.
No.
This is another thing I read about you. It said that, I guess this was in Medellin, I guess it was. You said you were on the deck strafing, and you took some 20 millimeters in the wing, resulting in some huge holes. It says you broke for the coast, and you stayed on the deck again until you were certain you were behind friendly lines. When you cut in, you were well behind your own landing strip, but you came on a British P-40 resupply unit. And this is a great story, because you bring this plane in with all the holes in the wing, and the British guy says, Yank, you've got a problem here.
Yeah.
That wasn't a British accent, but he said something to that effect.
Yeah,
huh?
That's exactly what he said. Yeah, you got a problem here.
Had you realized what poor condition your plane was in?
Oh, yeah. It flew poorly, very poorly, you know. It had big holes in that wing.
And holes in the gas tanks.
Yeah.
It was leaking gas. When you're flying that thing in, or were you concerned that, and you're flying over the sea, no less.
Yeah.
Are you mentally preparing for what you're going to do if you go in the water? I mean, what goes through your mind in a situation like that?
Oh, I don't think I'm thinking that far ahead, to tell you the truth. I just want to put it down where I think I'm going to make the best effort out of it.
So you made it there.
Made it.
But that plane with holes in the wings and gushing gas from ruptured gas tanks, it's not flyable. So that same guy who said you've got a problem, he asked you if you wanted another plane.
That's right. He asked me if I wanted another plane.
So, and typically, you're going to take off and land at an American base. In this case, you take your P-40, you fly this mission, you get all shot up, you land at a British base, the plane's not flyable, so they give you another plane.
Now you got the story right. I come in with a totally British-marked plane and park in my assigned parking space, and my crew chief jumps up on the and total mystery. He says, "How the hell did this happen? You go out in our plane, and you come back in this one." It's always a mystery.
It's a magic act.
Yeah, the magic.
And they, at that point, I mean, you've been gone for a while.
Oh, yeah.
You weren't back on time. They probably thought you might not be coming back.
No, that was the mystery of it, see, because I was past due to be back.
Mm-hmm.
And then I come in with this strange airplane. And that was, what the hell's going on? You know?
Yeah, I'm sure there were some wide eyes on your base after that. Can you, because most of us have never and will never be in that position you were in. When you're in the air and there are enemy planes all around you and they're firing at you, you're firing at them, you're trying to get out of their way, you're just trying to survive, what does that feel like?
Well, I don't know. I don't know that the proposition you hit me with there ever existed. We are frequently intercepted by German 109s, and there would be a battle, and then it would end. Most of the time, in a close battle, we were winners. And then, of course, the other thing is, the Germans didn't have as much equipment as we had. They were hurting. So we had an advantage that was hard for them to take advantage of.
And you flew 116 missions in P-40s over there. What did you come to appreciate about that particular airplane?
It would take a lot of damage, for one thing I liked about it. It would take a lot of damage and still fly.
Again, something that I read here, you had an author that was asking you about a probable kill in March of 43, and you said, I don't really know what you're talking about, but you said that there was a situation where you're escorting medium bombers, you were attacked by 109s, it became one big melee with airplanes going every which way, you jumped on the tail of a diving 109 and followed him down through a few thousand feet, firing 50 caliber and watching a mass of tracers seemingly enter throughout the fuselage. You didn't see the airplane go down because you had to break off, so you couldn't make a claim that you shot it down. But that sure sounds like you shot one down.
Well, yeah, that's as close as I ever came, that right there. That describes my situation. I followed him down, shot him, but I never saw him hit the water. So I can say what I said, that was it.
One of the famous incidents in the air war in North Africa, which, again, a lot of people don't really even know happened. They think of the air war in Europe and in the Pacific, and they forget the Mediterranean had a lot happening, too.
Yeah.
There was something called the Palm Sunday Massacre.
Oh, my. Oh, God. That's the one you shouldn't ask me about.
You're still upset?
Oh, yeah. I'm still upset.
Tell me why.
Well, we got word that we were subject to an attack, so we flew. We just kept flying mission after mission. We didn't know what was going to happen. And I flew the mission before the attack. I think two before. I flew two missions before they actually showed up. Then I'm back on the ground, and our guys intercept him. Old Ed wasn't there. Of course, I went up afterwards. We did another mission, but there weren't any Germans there.
So you've been hearing for all this time, they're coming. You keep flying, they don't come. The one day you take off, they show up, and the Americans shoot most of them down.
Yeah, well, this is all in the same hours, all in the same hours. From we heard they were coming, and we went up, nothing. Land, refuel, back up again, nothing. The next time I'm on the ground, the guys beat them. There they are, an old Duke sitting on the ground.
So what you're talking about, I mean, there are so many planes in the sky. This is something where someone could become an ace in a day.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And you wanted that chance.
I wanted that chance.
In all those years of being disappointed that you missed out, have you ever thought, well, wait a second, maybe they would have gotten me?
No, I've never I never considered that.
That's not the way a fighter pilot thinks, huh?
No, I never considered that.
Well, I think that's important for the rest of us to understand. We're getting inside the brain of a decorated fighter pilot, a man with the Distinguished Flying Cross twice over, decorated also with the Silver Star. And you continue flying. You guys were flying all these missions in North Africa, and then you got a little action in Sicily.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Was that different? The missions that you had to fly over Sicily, were they different from what you did in North Africa?
No. Most of it was dive bombing, of course, for ground targets. Most of what we did were ground targets. And now, I won't say regularly, because it didn't happen regularly, that the German Air Force would hit us. We pretty well ruined the German Air Force. Our biggest enemy was a ground fire, and they were damn good at that.
So you're flying a P-40 all this time, but we've talked about all the other American planes you had flown at one time or another. And here, when you're in the sky, your nemesis is the Messerschmitt, the ME-109. But you wanted to get in the cockpit of one of those and fly it?
I did.
Why?
Oh, it was the evidence of our enemy, the 109.
Yeah.
And I had to have one.
You just wanted to know what it felt like to be the other guy.
Yeah, well,
in that plane.
I just wanted to see what that airplane was like.
And you actually made that happen.
I made that happen.
Tell me how. How did you get yourself in the cockpit of an ME-109?
Well, I was the operations officer of the squadron, for one thing.
Yep, so you had rank.
Yeah, so the CO was a buddy of mine, so we didn't have any problem there.
So this is July 1943. The 8th Army is in the process of taking Sicily. And one German airfield was captured so quickly that the Luftwaffe didn't have time to destroy those aircraft. So here come a few functioning ME-109s that are left over, and one of them had your name on it, as far as you were concerned.
You know, it was just a quest that I just had to have.
Yeah, you couldn't think about anything else until you got that
ME-109. Yeah, got that 109.
Sure.
And then we got that little island, so the first thing I did is get over there with ahead of everybody else. Find a 109, lay claim to it till I got my crew over there, and they put the thing together, and I flew it out of there.
What was that like? Was it different?
Wonderful. Wonderful. It was just, it felt like you just, a heavy accomplishment. As you got this damn one up, and you got it, and you're flying it.
Uh-huh.
It's a hell of a deal.
You'd never been in the cockpit of one of those before. I have to imagine the controls were different from your American
planes.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. Everything was different. First place, the throttle was on the right side. Most everything in the cockpit was different. The instruments mostly were similar, different locations. You had to get familiar with it a little bit. It wasn't hard to fly. It wasn't hard to fly.
How far did you take it?
I brought it into our strip in Sicily, parked in my parking lot.
Again.
Yeah.
These strange planes keep showing up. Maybe this is a dumb question, but while you're flying that German plane with German markings, did you ever think, wait a second, I might be making myself a target here. What if somebody doesn't know it's me?
Well, that happened. I mean, when I got the crew up there to get me ready to fly the airplane, we painted stars on it.
Okay.
But that didn't make it an American airplane. We painted off the German markings. Well, yeah, it fooled people when I came landing in at our base with that damn 109. It was actually stupid because they were ready to shoot it down.
I was going to say, that's what I would have done.
Yeah, they're ready to shoot it down. I tried to minimize it by going up and down the runway a few times and shaking the wings.
So you waved to him, but you couldn't talk to him on the radio because it's a German plane.
No, I couldn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And so they were confused about that airplane. It had American markings on it. The guys go rocking the wings down the runway, And so, but they came damn close to shooting it.
Did you discover that later after talking
oh,
to
yeah.
them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The anti-aircraft was British.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they weren't to be fooled just because the markings were different. They saw that damn 109.
Well, I'm glad that we're sitting here talking.
Me too.
But I realize you missed your chance at history there. You could have been the only pilot in the whole war to be shot down as an American pilot flying a German plane shot down by British anti-aircraft.
I'm sorry. I have to apologize.
I'm glad that's some history you didn't make. Not long after that, you come back to the States.
Yeah.
The war's still going on. We're still 9 months away from D-Day. I mean, we're not even, the war isn't even really half over, but you've already flown 116 missions. So you come back to the States. Tell me what you did back home in America.
Well, I got assigned to the training command, of course.
But that would not last forever. When we come back, we're going to find out how 95-year-old Ed Ellington got back into flying combat missions. And the biggest reason, he's very thankful he did. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Ed Ellington, was a decorated fighter pilot in World War II, flying first in North Africa, later in Italy with the 57th Fighter Group. One of the photos that you'll find at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page shows you the right wing of a P-40 that Ed was flying with the 65th Fighter Squadron, bombing and strafing Erwin Rommel's forces in March of 1943. You heard him describe a hole he could put his head through. Well, when you see the hole in this wing, you're going to realize you might fit a few heads through there. When we left off, he had flown 116 missions in the Mediterranean and had been brought back to the U.S. to train other pilots. But you weren't a big fan of that, were you?
Well, let's see now. I was found that it was a very boring thing.
You were training P-47 pilots?
Yeah, that's right. Got into P-47s and said, the hell with this, I'm going back over. Got myself into my old squadron. I had to bully myself into my old squadron.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. How'd you pull this off? Because, I mean, as far as the government's concerned, you've done your part. You flew 116 missions. You can ride out the rest of the war training people in the States.
Yeah.
That didn't float your boat.
No. I was not happy with the stateside assignments. It had become what I called so stateside compared to our life in combat. Then I'm going through that, and I was simply bored, absolutely bored. And I went down to talk to them and let me go back over.
So you joined them again in Italy, and you would fly close to 70 more missions by the time Italy fell. You're still over there when the war in Europe ended, and you were about ready to go fly in the Pacific too,
yeah,
weren't you?
I did. I went to the Pacific.
You guys were in the Panama Canal when the atomic bomb was dropped.
Yeah.
When you think back on it, 180 missions. Holy moly. I've talked to a lot of guys who've flown a lot of missions. I don't know if I've talked to someone who's flown 180 missions. And when you went back, those were in P-47s?
Yeah.
When you came back the second time? Was that a better airplane than the P-40?
Oh, far. Far.
What made it superior?
Well, first it had a lot more performance. A lot more performance. It was less vulnerable. It was a hell of an airplane all the way around. It could push it out and it could take it.
Did you feel safer in the P-47?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
A lot of the veterans that I've interviewed, it's amazing the ways in which they met their wife And then we think of children and grandchildren and all these people who would have never been born if that chance meeting didn't occur. You met your wife during World War II, did you not?
She was a nurse in Italy.
Tell me about it. How'd you guys meet?
I had just gotten back over. It was right on the coast. There's this hospital. My CO, my classmate, Gil Wyman, was dating Dottie Knauer, a nurse in the 105th Station Hospital. I knew he had a girlfriend at home, so I didn't feel like I was. I just nudged right in and said, you know, Gil, we just made it right off the bat and made me a happy man forever.
So you stole your buddy's girlfriend.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But it wasn't all sunshine and roses. You had an incident where you borrowed your friend's Jeep and you two were driving in the middle of the night and you almost went off a cliff in the Jeep.
True. All true.
Tell me about it. What happened?
Well, we were going out to where there was a place to go out and have a drink and have a party and so on out on the beach there. And we were headed out there. We'd been raining for about 3 days. And we came at the last minute. I see that the bridge is washed out. I mean, it was gone. So I jerked the old Jeep around and kept us from going down in that water. But in the process, I hit the bridge on Dottie's side, broke her leg, broke her arm. All I got was a little, my head, the steering wheel. I just got out and I look at this and I'm just, you know how guilty you are.
Sure.
And so I start running down the road to get help. And then all of a sudden I see a car with lights coming toward me. And I stopped him and I said, boy, I got a problem. You got to take me down and back to the thing. And the guy in a GI truck rolled on up and helped me get Dottie out of that damn Jeep. And she had all this damage. And they were very careful and they got her in the Jeep. And we went back to her hospital and brought her in there all bunged up, you know, poor woman.
And so she was in the hospital for weeks.
Yeah.
And you kept flying back to see her.
Yeah.
And she ended up going back to the States.
Yeah.
And she got back in April of 45. And she was still recovering at a hospital in Cleveland when you got back from the war in September. And you waited an awfully long time to get married, didn't you?
Yeah. About a week.
What was it about her? Were you just feeling so bad for almost killing her in the Jeep?
No,
or was
no,
there something
was,
special
I,
about
I,
her?
I was mad about her. She was a great woman. Great woman. I say that to this day. Boy, she was a great woman. I was just a lucky guy.
Well, it just hit me that I guess that's why you had to go back over there. You know, when you had your 116 missions and you're back in the States training guys and it just wasn't good enough. If you hadn't have gone back over there, you never would have met Dottie.
Never would have met her. No, it was just the right thing to do.
And I bet you can't imagine your life any different.
No, I can't. No, you're absolutely right. Dottie didn't want a bunch of kids, and I was then a practicing Catholic, and I gave her 5.
Not bad.
Not bad. She was a great woman. Boy, you can't imagine how I miss her right now.
Is that a little hard to believe when you're listening to your own story as I read you some of your recollections and you go back there mentally, but to think about the kid from South Dakota who flies 180 missions, almost dies more times than he can count in air combat, Silver Star, Distinguished Flying Cross, goes back a second time, meets this lady, almost kills her in a car wreck, comes back home, marries her, and has 5 kids. That's not believable, is it?
Maybe I just made all this up, huh?
We still don't know where you were when you came back in that British airplane. So maybe you were plotting it there. Well, in all seriousness, though, how do you explain that? Because it is pretty remarkable that things worked out the way they did. Do you think you were just lucky? Was somebody looking out for you?
Of course. Well, there may be some part of that. But I, as far as I'm concerned, I was just lucky. You get so damn many missions of danger, you're still okay. It just has to be luck.
Some guys were not as lucky.
No, that's the thing. What if so many guys, maybe on a first mission, get it?
And you had a lot of guys that you knew really well that didn't come back.
No, it's true.
You ever think about them and wonder what their lives would have been like?
No, not really. Not what their life would have been like. No, I never have had those thoughts. I think you expect the worst could happen to you. You could get it on the first mission or whatever. You could be a goner early on or anywhere along the way. And so that you were, it's just sheer luck.
We talked about how badly you wanted to fly the German fighter plane, the ME-109 that had been your nemesis in North Africa. Later on in the war, you really wanted to experience a P-51 Mustang, and I know you get the chance to do that quite a bit. Here, you had signed up before America was in World War II, before Pearl Harbor, and you stayed in the service for nearly 30 years.
I stayed in and retired.
You retired as a colonel in 1968. Yeah. So what other aircraft did you get to fly over the years?
I flew the 51 a lot after the war. I got the jet program at Eglin Field, first in the P-80s, then the P-84s. I got a lot of experience at Eglin Field in jets.
And that was all experimental at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You were a test pilot.
Yeah, it was operational suitability testing. The experimental testing had been done.
So this is, they think they're going to work, but how are they actually going to work in combat?
Yeah.
And exactly. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Can you help us understand what a quantum leap that was from propeller-driven P-40s and P-47s and even P-51s to this jet technology?
Well, it was quite a bit of difference in performance. You went rambling down the runway at a higher speed when you did the takeoff, and then you, when you're airborne, you could be up to a high rate or speed, and it was gorgeous. It was great.
I know you had a long, long career. What would you say you're most proud of in terms of your service to our country?
I guess I'd have to go back to my years of combat.
Because it took some skill to do what you did, didn't it?
Yeah, I did. I did that under tough conditions. Well, the other stuff after the war was pretty straightforward.
I don't know if I've ever asked someone this before. But just in listening to you talk, how much you enjoyed flying all those missions in North Africa and Italy, that once you were sent back home, you couldn't stay home. You had to get back over there and fly some more missions. They're sending you to the Pacific to fly even more missions. And here you are coming through the Panama Canal. You hear about the atomic bomb, and now all of a sudden the war is coming to an end. Was there part of you that was disappointed you weren't going to fly any more combat missions?
No, I don't think I felt that way. No, I don't think I disappointed the war ended.
What did that feel like, to know that here's something that this has been your life for several years here, this crusade to free the world, and now victory was accomplished? What did that mean to you?
Great deal of pleasure that this was over with. I don't think I was at all wishing we could go on. No, I think that was a very pleasurable thing that you participated in this and it was over.
And you wanted to go find Dottie.
Yeah, exactly.
Had you already asked her to marry you before you saw her again? Or did you ask her there in the hospital?
Oh, no, in the hospital. Oh, yeah. In fact, I got her out of the hospital and married her. That was the way it went.
So you show up. She's still in the hospital from this wreck you two had been in Italy. You show up at the hospital, she's in the hospital bed, and you say, will you marry me?
That's right. Right on. She said, yeah.
You got some guts.
I thought, well, I gotta act now, or maybe I'm a little loser. Yeah, and so I got her out of the hospital and got her the justice of the peace, all like this.
Uh-huh. What amazes you the most about your story and how it all worked out?
Well, I think what amazes me most is I made it. I think that does amaze me most, because there were so many situations. Could have been the end of everything. So having lived through it amazes me.
Me too.
Does it?
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me some of your pretty unique stories. Let me ask you one more thing. Have you been able to go, I know you live in Washington, as in Seattle, but have you been able to go to Washington, D.C. and see the National World War II Memorial?
Yeah, I've seen that.
What did you think of that when you look out and you see all those gold stars symbolizing 400,000 Americans who died in World War II?
Now that you ask me that question, I'm not ever aware that I asked myself that question.
Is that a heavy number for you?
Oh, my God, yes. 400,000?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a heavy number for me. That staggers me. 400,000. Boy, doesn't that draw lines and everything you can think of under the fruitlessness, uselessness of war, and that we're still willing to do it.
Some powerful perspective today from 95-year-old Ed Ellington of Seattle, Washington, a retired Air Force colonel who joined the Army Air Corps before America's entrance into World War II. And flew 180 missions over the course of the war. You'll find photos of Duke Ellington, as his fellow pilots called him, at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.